The Masters.
The Masters was my first published, genuine, authentic, real, virgin wool science fiction story. By which I mean a story in which, or to which, the existence and the accomplishments of science are, in some way, essential. At least, that is what I mean by science fiction on Mondays. On Tuesdays, sometimes I mean something else. Some science fiction writers detest science, its spirit, method, and works. Others like it. Some are anti-technology. Others are technology worshippers. I seem to be rather bored by complex technology, but fascinated by biology, psychology, and the speculative ends of astronomy and physics, insofar as I can follow them. The figure of the scientist is a quite common one in my stories, and most often a rather lonely one, isolated, an adventurer, out on the edge of things. The theme of this story is one I returned to later, with considerably better equipment. It has a good sentence in it, though. He had been trying to measure the distance between the earth and God.
In darkness, a man stood alone, naked, holding a smoking torch. The reddish glow lit air and ground for only a few feet. Beyond that was the darkness, the immeasurable. From moment to moment, there was a rush of wind, a half-glimpsed glitter of eyes, a vast muttering. "Hold it higher!" The man obeyed, though the torch shook in his shaking hands. He raised it clear above his head while the darkness rushed and jabbered around him, closing in. The wind blew colder. The red flame guttered. His rigid arms began to quiver, then to jerk a little. His face was oily with sweat. He barely heard the soft, huge jabbering. "Hold it up! Up! Hold it up!" The current of time had stopped. Only the whispering grew and grew till it was a howling, and still, horribly, nothing touched him. Nothing came within the circle of light. "Now walk," the great voice howled. "Walk forward." The torch above his head, he stepped forward on the ground he could not see. It was not there. With a scream for help, he fell, darkness and thunder about him, the torch he would not let go flaming backward into his eyes. Time. Time and light and pain. They had all started again. He was crouching in some kind of ditch, on all fours in the mud. His face stung and his eyes, in this bright light, were full of fog. He looked up from his mud-blotched nakedness to a blurred, radiant figure standing above him. Light fell in glory on white hair, the long folds of a white cloak. The eyes gazed at Genil. The voice spoke to him. "You lie in the grave. You lie in the grave of knowledge. So lie your forefathers forever beneath the ashes of the fires of hell." The voice swelled out. "O fallen man, arise!" Genil managed to get to his feet. The white figure was pointing. "That is the light of human reason. It guided you to the grave. Drop it." Genil realized he was still holding a mud-sodden black stick, the torch. He let it fall. "Now rise," the white figure cried in a slow exultation. "Rise from darkness and walk in the light of common day." Hands reached to Genil, helping and hauling him up. Men knelt offering him basins and sponges. Others toweled him, rubbed him down till he stood clean and warm, a grey cloak round his shoulders, amid the chatting and laughter coming and going in the bright, spacious hall. A bald man clapped his shoulder.
"Come on, time for the oath."
Did I do all right?"
"Fine. Only you held up that damn fool torch so long. Thought you'd keep us growling around in the dark all day. Come on."
They led him over black pavement and under the very lofty white-beamed ceiling, to a curtain that dropped pure white in a few straight folds, 30 feet from roof to floor.
"Curtain of mystery," somebody said to Keneal in a matter-of-fact tone.
Laughing and talking had died away. They stood all round him, silent. In silence, the white curtain parted. Keneal stared foggily at what was revealed. A high altar, a long table, and an old man in white.
"Postulant, will you swear our oath with us?"
Somebody nudged Keneal, whispering,
"I will."
"I will," Keneal stuttered.
"Swear, then, masters of the rite."
The old man raised up a shape of silver, an X cross supported by an iron shaft.
"Under the cross of the common day, I swear never to reveal the rites and mysteries of my lodge."
"Under the cross, I swear the rites," muttered all the men around Keneal.
And propelled by another nudge, he muttered with them.
"To live well, to work well, to think well."
As Keneal finished repeating this, a voice whispered in his ear,
"Don't swear."
"To avoid all heresies, to betray all necromancers to the courts of college, and to obey the high masters of my lodge from now forth till my death."
Mutter, mutter. Some seemed to be repeating the long passage, some not. Keneal, confused, muttered a word or two and then stood silent.
"And I swear never to teach the mysteries of machinery to any genteel. I swear this beneath the sun."
A grating rumble almost drowned their voices. Slowly, crankily, a section of the roof was swinging back to reveal the yellow-gray cloud-covered sky of summer.
"Behold the light of common day," the old man in white cried out triumphant,
and Keneal stared up at it. The machinery apparently stuck before the skylight was fully open. There was a loud clanking of gears, then silence. The old man came forward, kissed Keneal on both cheeks, and said,
"Welcome, Master Keneal, to the inner rite of the mystery of the machine."
The initiation was over. Keneal was a master of his lodge.
"Mean burn you got there,"
the bold fellow said as they all walked back down the hall. Keneal put up his hand and found that his left cheek and temple were raw and sore.
"Lucky it missed your eye."
"Just missed being blinded by the light of reason, eh?"
said a soft voice. Glancing round, Keneal saw a fair man, with brown hair and blue eyes, actually blue, like those of an albino cat or a blind horse. He looked away from the deformity at once, but the fair man went on in his soft voice, the voice that had whispered,
"Don't swear,"
during the taking of the oath.
"I'm Mayday Fairman. I'll be your co-master in Lee's shop. Feel like getting a beer when we're out of here?"
The dank, beard-reggy warmth of the tavern was a queer change from all the terror and ceremony of the day. Keneal felt dizzy. Mayday Fairman drank off half a tankard, wiped foam pleasurably off his mouth, and inquired,
"What do you think of the initiation?"
It was...
"Humbling?"
"Yes," Keneal agreed. "Really humbling."
"Humiliating, even?"
the blue-eyed man suggested.
"Yes, a great mystery."
Perplexed, Keneal stared down into his beer. Mede smiled and said in his soft voice,
"I know. Drink up now. I think you ought to have an apothecary look at that burn."
Keneal obediently followed him out into the evening, into the narrow streets thronged with pedestrians, horse carts, ox carts, chuffing motor carts. In the merchant's place, the booths of the artisans were being closed for the night, and down High Street the great doors of the shops and lodges were already barred. Here and there the overhung, elbowing houses were parted by the blank yellow facade of a temple, marked with one plain circle of polished brass. In the dull, brief summer twilight under the unmoving clouds, The black-haired, bronze-skinned people of the common day crowded and idled and pushed and talked and cursed and laughed. And Ganil, dizzy from fatigue and pain and strong beer, kept close beside Mede as if, for all his own new masterhood, this blue-eyed stranger were his only guide.
XVI plus IXX, Ganil said impatiently. What the devil, boy, can't you add?
The apprentice flushed red.
Isn't it XXXVI then, Master Ganil?
He asked feebly. For answer, Ganil jammed one of the rods the boy had been machining into its place in the steam engine that was being repaired. It was too long by an inch.
It's because my rule of thumb's so long, sir,
the boy said, displaying his knobby hands. The distance between first and second thumb joint was, in fact, unusually long. So it is, Ganil said. His dark face darkened. Very interesting.
But it doesn't matter how long your inch is, so long as you use it consistently. And what matters, you blockhead, is that XVI and IXX don't make XXXVI. Never have, never can, never will till the world ends, you incompetent Gentile.
Yes, sir. It's so hard to remember, sir.
It's intended to be hard to remember, one apprentice, said a deep voice.
Lee, the shopmaster. A fat, deep-chested man with bright black eyes.
Come over here a minute, Ganil.
Leading him to a quieter corner of the great workshop, Lee went on cheerfully.
You're a bit impatient, Master Ganil.
One should know his addition tables.
Even masters forget an addition now and then, you know.
Lee patted Ganil's shoulder in a fatherly way.
Why, you sounded for a moment there as if you expected him to compute it.
He laughed aloud, a fine bass laugh through which his eyes gleamed merrily and with infinite shrewdness.
Take it easy, that's all. I understand you're coming for dinner next Alter Day Eve.
I took the liberty.
Fine, more power to you. Wish she'd take on a good steady fellow like you. But I give you fair warning. My daughter's a willful hussy.
Again the master laughed and Ganil grinned a little ruefully. The shopmaster's daughter, Lani, had not only most of the young men of the shop, but also her father, twisted right round her little finger. A clever, quicksilver girl, she had at first rather scared Ganil. It took him a while to notice that she spoke, to him only, with a certain shyness, a hint almost of pleading. He had finally got up courage to ask a dinner invitation from her mother, the recognized first step of a courtship. He stood now where Lee had left him, thinking of Lani's smile.
Ganil, have you ever seen the sun?
It was a low voice, dry and easy. He turned, meeting his friend's blue eyes. The sun? Yes, of course I have.
When was the last time?
Let's see, I was 26, 4 years ago. Weren't you here in Idun then? It came out in late afternoon, and that night there were stars. I counted 81, I remember, before the sky closed.
I was up north in Keeling then, in my first mastership.
Mede leaned against the wooden guardrail of the model-heavy steam engine as he spoke. His light eyes looked away from the busy shop, out the windows at the fine, steady rain of late autumn.
Heard you telling off young Wano just now.
What matters is that XVI and IXX don't make XXXVI. Or when I was 26 4 years ago, I counted 81 stars.
A little more and you'd be computing, Ganil.
Ganil frowned, unconsciously rubbing the whitish scar on his temple.
Well, hell, Mayday, even Gentiles know IV from XXXI.
Mayday smiled faintly. He had his comparing stick in his hand, and lowering it, he drew on the dusty floor a round shape.
What's that?
He asked. The sun.
Right. It's also a figure. A number. The figure for nothing.
The figure for nothing?
Yes. You could use it in the subtraction tables, for instance. I from II leaves I. Right? But what does II from II leave?
A pause. He tapped the circle with his stick.
That.
Yes, of course. Ganeel stared down at the circle, the sacred image of the sun, the hidden light, the face of God. Is that priest knowledge?
No.
Mayday drew an X cross over the circle.
That is.
Then what? Whose knowledge is the figure for nothing?
No one's. Anyone's. It's not a mystery.
Ganeel frowned in surprise at this statement. They spoke in low voices, standing close as if discussing a measurement on Mayday's comparing stick.
Why did you count the stars, Ganeel?
I wanted to know. I've always liked counting numbers, the tables. That's why I'm a mechanic.
Yes. You're 30, aren't you? You've been a master for 4 months now. Did you ever think, Ganeel, that to be a master means you have learned everything your trade can teach? From now on until your death, you'll learn nothing more. There is no more.
But the shopmasters...
Shopmasters learn some secret signals and passwords,
Mayday said in his soft, dry voice.
And of course they have power. But they know no more than you. You thought perhaps they were allowed to compute, didn't you? They aren't.
Ganeel was silent.
And yet there are things to be learned, Ganeel.
Where? Outside. There was a long pause. I can't listen to this, Mayday. Don't speak of it again. I won't betray you. Ganeel turned and walked away, his face harsh with anger. With all his will, he turned that confused and struggling anger against Mayday. A man as deformed of mind as of body. An evil counselor. A lost friend. It had been a pleasant evening. Lee jovial, his fat wife motherly, and Lani shy and radiant. Ganeel's youthful gravity made her tease him, but even in her teasing was that pleading, yielding note. Another moment, it seemed, and all her verve would turn to tenderness. Passing a dish at table once, her hand had for an instant touched his. He still knew exactly where, there, the side of his right hand near the wrist, one soft touch. He moaned luxuriously as he lay in bed in his room over the shop in the utter blackness of the city night. Oh, Lani, soft touch of a hand, of lips. Oh, Lord, Lord. Courtship was a long business, 8 months at least, going from step to step as one must with a master's daughter. Ganeel had to get his mind off this unendurable sweetness. Think of nothing, he told himself firmly. Go to sleep. Think of nothing. And he thought of nothing. The circle, the round, empty circle. What was I times zero? The same as II times zero. What if you put I beside zero? What would that figure be? 10? Mayday Fairman sat up in bed, brown hair lank over groggy blue eyes, and tried to focus on the person crashing around his room. The first dirty yellow light of dawn showed at the window.
This is Alter Day, he growled. Go away, I'm sleepy.
The vague figure resolved into Ganeel, the crashing into a whisper.
Mayday,
Ganeel kept whispering.
Look.
He stuck a slate under Mayday's nose.
Look, look what you can do with that figure for nothing.
Oh, that,
said Mayday. He pushed Ganeel and the slate away, went and dunked his head in the basin of icy water on his clothes chest, and kept it there a while. He returned, dripping, to sit on the bed.
Let's see. See, you can use any number for a base. I used XII because it's handy. XII becomes 1-0, see? And XIII is 1-1. Then when you get up to XXIV, shh.
Mayday studied the slate. Finally, he said,
will you remember this?
and at Ganil's nod, wiped the neat, crowded figures off the slate with a rub of his sleeve.
I hadn't realized that one could use any base. But look, use the base X. I'll tell you why in a minute. And here's a device that makes it easier. Now, X will be 10 and XI will be II, but for XII, write this.
And he wrote on the slate, 12. Ganil stared at the figure. At last he said in a peculiar, struggling voice,
"Isn't that one of the black numbers?" "Yes, it is. All you've done, Ganil, is to come at the black numbers by the back door."
Ganil sat beside him, silent.
"What's CXX times MCC?"
Mayday inquired. "The tables don't go that high.
Watch."
Mayday wrote on the slate, 1200 over 120. And then, as Ganil watched, 4 zeros, then 2400 underneath that, and 1200 directly beneath that. He drew a horizontal line, and then underneath, 144,000. Another long pause.
3 nothings. XII times itself.
"Give me the slate," Ganil muttered. Then after a silence broken only by the patter of rain and the squeak of chalk on slate, "What's the black number for VIII? By twilight of that cold altar day, they had gone as far as Mayday could take Ganil. Indeed, Ganil had gone farther than Mayday could follow him.
"You must meet Yin," the fair man said. "He can teach you what you need. Yin works with angles, triangles, measurements. He can measure the distance between any 2 points, points you can't reach using his triangles. He is a great learner. Numbers are the heart of this knowledge, the language of it."
"And my own language?"
"Yes, it is."
"Not mine. I don't love numbers for themselves. I want to use them to explain things. For instance, if you throw a ball, what makes the ball move?"
"You're throwing it."
Ganil grinned. White as a sheet, much whiter than Mayday's sheets, his head ringing with 16 straight hours of mathematics, minus meals or sleep. He had lost all fear, all humility. His smile was that of a king come home from exile.
"Fine," said Mayday, "why does it keep on moving?"
Because the air holds it up."
"Then why does it ever fall? Why does it follow a curve? What kind of curve is it? Do you see how I need your numbers?"
It was Mayday who now looked like a king, an angry king with an empire too immense to control.
"And they talk about mysteries," he snorted, "in their little shuttered shops. Here, come on, let's get some dinner and go see Yin."
Built right up against the city wall, the tall old house peered from leaded windows at the two young masters down in the street. Sulphurous late autumn twilight hung over the steep slate roofs shining with rain.
"Yin was a machine master like us,"
Mayday told Ganil as they waited at the iron-barred door.
"Retired now, you'll see why. Men from all the lodges come here. Apothecaries, weavers, masons, even some artisans.
One butcher, he cuts up dead cats." Mayday spoke with amused tolerance, as physicists generally speak of biologists. Now the door swung open, and a servant took them upstairs to a room where logs glowed on a great hearth, and a man rose from a high-backed oaken chair to greet them. Ganil thought at once of the overmaster of his lodge, the figure that had cried down to him in his grave.
"Arise."
Yin, too, was old and tall and wore the white cloak of the high masters. But he stooped, and his face was creased and weary as an old hound's. He held out his left hand to greet them. His right arm ended in a long-heeled, shiny stump at the wrist.
"This is Ganil," Mayday was saying. "He invented the duodecimal system last night. Get him working on the mathematics of curves for me, Master Yin."
Yin laughed, an old man's short, soft laugh.
"Welcome, Keneal, from now on, come here when you please. We're all necromancers here. We practice the black arts, or try to. Come freely, day or night, and go freely. If we're betrayed, so be it. We must trust one another. Mystery belongs to no man. We're not keeping a secret, but practicing an art. Does that make sense to you?
Keneal nodded. Words never came easily to him, only numbers, and he found himself very moved, which embarrassed him. This was no solemn symbolic initiation and oath, but only an old man talking quietly.
Good,
said Yin, as if Keneal's nod had been quite sufficient.
Some wine, young masters, or ale? My dark ale came out first rate this year. So, you like numbers, do you, Keneal?
In early spring, Keneal stood in the shop, supervising Wano, as the prentice took measurements onto his comparing stick from the model of the hauling cart engine. Keneal's face was grim. He had changed over these few months, looked older, more resolute, harder. 4 hours sleep a night plus the invention of algebra might well change a man.
Master Keneal,
said a shy voice. Repeat that measurement, he told Wano, and then turned questioningly to the girl. Lani, too, had changed. Her face looked a little cross, a little forlorn, and she spoke to Keneal with real timidity. He had taken the second step of courtship, the 3 evening calls, and then, becoming absorbed in his work with Yin, had gone no further. No man had ever dropped Lani in the middle of a courtship. No man had ever looked right through her as he was doing now. What was it he saw when he looked through her? She was wild to know that, to get at his secret, to get at him. In a vague, unquantifiable way, he knew this, and was sorry for Lani, and a little afraid of her. She was watching Wano.
Do you ever change those measurements?
She asked, trying to make conversation. To change a model is the heresy of invention. That ended that.
My father wanted me to tell you the shop will be shut tomorrow.
Shut? Why's that?
The college has announced there's a west wind rising, and the sun may come out tomorrow.
Good. A good beginning for the spring, eh? Thanks. And he turned back to the model. The priests of the college had for once been right. Weather prediction, on which they spent most of their waking hours, was a thankless task. But once in 10 tries or so they caught a sun, and this was one of the times. By noon the rains had ceased, and the cloud cover was paling, beginning to boil and flow slowly eastward. By mid-afternoon all the people of Idun were out on the streets and squares, on chimney pots and roof trees, on the wall and the fields beyond the wall, watching. The priests of the college had begun their ceremonial dance, bowing and interweaving on the great forecourt of the college. Priests stood ready in every temple to pull chains that would open the roofs so that the sun's light might strike the altar stones. And in late afternoon, at last, the sky opened. Between ragged smoking edges of yellow-grey appeared a streak of blue. A sigh, a soft, tremendous murmur rose up from the streets, squares, windows, roofs, walk of the city of Idun. Heaven! Heaven! The rent in the sky widened. A shower of rain spattered over the city, blown aslant on the fresh wind. And suddenly the raindrops glittered, as at night in torchlight. But this glory they reflected was the glory of the sun. To westward it stood, all alone in heaven, blinding. Keneal stood with the others, face lifted. On his face, on the scar of his burn, he felt the heat of the sun.
He stared at it till his eyes swam with tears. The circle of fire, the face of God. What is the sun? That was Mayday's soft voice, remembered. A cold midwinter night, he and Mayday and Yin and the others talking before the fire in Yin's house.
Is it a circle or a sphere? Why does it cross the sky? And how big is it? How far away is it? Ah, to think that once all a man had to do to see the sun was lift up his head.
Flutes and drums throbbed, a gay, faint sound, away off at the college. Sometimes cloud fragments blew across the intolerable face, and the world turned grey and chill again. The flutes stopped, but the west wind blew. The clouds passed and the sun reappeared, always a little lower. Just before it sank into the heavy cloud rack in the west, it was growing red, and one could look at it without pain. In those moments it certainly looked to Ganil's eyes not like a disc, but like an enormous, haze-warped, slowly falling ball. It fell, was gone. Overhead through the torn sky, glimpses of heaven still shone, clear and deep, blue-green. Then westward, near where the sun had set, at the edge of a mounting cloud, gleamed one bright point, the evening star.
Look!
Ganil cried, but few turned to look. The sun was set. What did stars matter? The yellowish haze, part of this single winding sheet of cloud that had covered Earth with its mantle of dust and rain ever since Hellfire 14 generations ago, moved up over the star, erased it. Ganil sighed, rubbed his neck that was stiff with craning, and started home along with all the other people of the common day. He was arrested that night. From guards and fellow prisoners, all his shop was in jail with him except the shopmaster Lee. He learned that his crime was that of knowing Mayday Fairman. Mayday stood accused of heresy. He had been seen out on the fields pointing an instrument at the sun, a device, they said, for measuring distances. He had been trying to measure the distance between the earth and God. The apprentices were soon let go. On the third day, guards came for Ganil, bringing him out into one of the enclosed courts of the college, into the soft, fine rain of early spring. Priests lived almost wholly out of doors, and the great complex of Idun College was only a series of meagre barracks surrounding the roofless sleeping courts, writing courts, prayer courts, eating courts, and courts of law. Into one of these they brought Ganil, forcing him on between the ranks of men robed in white and yellow that filled it, until he stood in front of them all. He saw a clear space, an altar, a long table shining wet with rain, and behind it a priest in the golden robe of the high mystery. At the far end of the table was another man who, like Ganil, was flanked by guards. This man was looking at Ganil, a straight look, cold and blank, yet they were blue eyes, the same blue as heaven above the clouds. Ganil Karlsson of Idun, you are suspect as an acquaintance of Mayday Fairman, accused of the heresies of invention and computation. You were this man's friend?
We were co-masters,
yes. Did he ever speak to you of measurements made without comparing sticks?
No.
Of black numbers?
No.
Of the black arts?
No.
Master Ganil, you've answered no 3 times. Do you know the order of the priestmasters of the mystery of the law concerning suspects in heresy?
No, I don't.
The order says, if the suspect shall deny the questions 4 times, the questions may be repeated with use of the hand press until answered. I shall now repeat, unless you wish to retract one of your denials.
No,
Ganil said, confused, looking round him at the crowded blank faces, the high walls.
When they had brought out a squat wooden machine of some kind and had locked his right hand into it, he was still more confused than scared. What was all this mumbo-jumbo? It was like his initiation when they had worked so hard to frighten him. That time, they had succeeded. "As a mechanic," the Golden Priest was saying, "you know the use of the lever, Master Ganeel. Will you retract?" "No," Ganeel said, frowning a little. He had noticed that his right arm now seemed to end at the wrist, like Yin's. "Very well." One of the guards put his hands on the lever sticking out of the wooden box, and the Golden Priest said, "Were you a friend of Medifermin?" "No," Ganeel said. He said no to each question, even after he had ceased to hear the priest's voice. He went on saying no till he heard his own voice mixed with the clapping echo from the walls above the courtyard. "No, no, no, no." The light came and went. The rain fell cold on his face and ceased. Somebody kept trying to help him stand up. His grey cloak stank. He had been sick with pain. At the thought, he was sick again. "Take it easy now," a guard was whispering to him. The motionless white and yellow ranks were still crowded there, the faces set, the eyes staring. But not at him now. "Heretic, do you know this man?"
"He is my co-master."
"Did you speak to him of the black arts?"
"Yes."
"Did you teach him the black arts?"
"No, I tried to."
The voice cracked a little. Even in the silence of the courtyard, over only the whisper of the rain, it was hard to hear Mede speak.
"He was too stupid. He dared not and could not learn. He'll make a fine shopmaster."
The cold blue eyes looked straight at Ganeel without pity or appeal. The Golden Priest turned to face the court again. "There is no evidence against the suspect, Ganeel. You may go, suspect. Come here at noon tomorrow to witness the execution of judgment. Failure to come will be taken as proof of your guilt." Before he understood, the guards had led Ganeel out of the courtyard. They left him at a side door of the college, barring the door behind him with a clang. He stood there a while, then crouched down on the pavement, pressing his blackened, blood-caked hand against his side under his cloak. Rain whispered around him. No one passed. It was not till dusk that he pulled himself up and walked, street by street, house by house, step by step, across the city to Yin's house. In the shadows of the doorway, a shadow moved, spoke.
"Ganeel."
He stopped.
"Ganeel, I don't care if you're a suspect. It's all right. Come back home with me. My father will take you back into the shop. He will if I ask him."
Ganeel was silent.
"Come with me. I waited for you. I knew you'd come here. I've followed you before."
Her nervous, jubilant laugh died away. "Let me by, Lonnie."
"No. Why do you come to old Yin's house? Who lives here? Who is she? Come back with me. You have to. My father won't take a suspect back into his shop unless I..."
Yin's door was never locked. Ganeel brushed past her and went in, shutting it behind him. No servant came. The house was dark, silent. They had all been taken, all the learners. They would all be questioned and tortured and killed.
"Who's that?"
Yin stood on the stair landing, lamplight bright on his white hair. He came to Ganeel and helped him up the stairs. Ganeel spoke very fast.
"I was followed here. A girl from the shop, Lee's daughter. If she tells him he'll recognize your name, he'll send the guards here."
"I sent the others away 3 days ago."
At the sound of Yin's voice, Ganeel stopped, stared at the old man's creased, quiet face, and then said childishly, "Look," holding out his right hand, "look, like yours."
"Yes, come sit down, Ganeel."
"They condemned him, not me, they let me go.
He said he couldn't teach me, I couldn't learn. To save me.
And your mathematics. Come here now, sit down.
Ganil got control of himself and obeyed. Yin made him lie down, then did what he could about cleaning and bandaging his hand. Then, sitting down between Ganil and the glowing fire, he gave a wheezy sigh.
Well, he said. Now you're a heresy suspect. I've been one for 20 years. You get used to it. Don't worry about our friends. But if the girl tells Lee and your name gets linked with mine... We'd better leave, Idun. Separately, but tonight.
Ganil said nothing. To leave his shop without the Overmaster's permission meant excommunication, the loss of his mastership. He would be barred from his own trade. What could he do with his crippled hand? Where could he go? He had never been out of Idun in his life. The silence of the house spread out above and below them. Ganil strained to hear sounds down in the street. The tramping of a troop of guards come to rearrest him. He had to get out, to get away tonight. I can't, he said abruptly. I have to be at the college tomorrow at noon. Yin knew what he meant. Again the silence closed round them. The old man's voice was very dry and weary when he finally spoke.
That's the condition of your release, eh? All right, go do it. You don't want them hunting you through the 40 towns as a condemned heretic. A suspect isn't hunted, merely outcast. It's preferable. Get some sleep now, Ganil. Before I go, I'll tell you where to meet me. Leave as soon as you can and travel light.
When Ganil left the house late in the morning, however, he carried something with him, a roll of papers hidden under his cloak, each sheet covered edge to edge with Mede Fairman's clear writing. Trajectories, speed of falling bodies, the nature of motion. Yin had left before daybreak, jogging calmly out of town on a grey donkey.
I'll see you in Keeling,
had been his only parting with Ganil. Ganil had seen none of the other learners, only serfs, servants, beggars, truant schoolboys, and women with their nursemaids and whining children stood with him now, in the dull light of noon on the great forecourt of the college. Only riffraff and the idle gathered to see a heretic die. A priest had ordered Ganil to stand at the very front of the crowd. Many people glanced curiously at him, standing there alone in his master's cloak. On the other side of the square, in the front of the crowd, he saw a girl in a violet gown. He was not sure it was Lani. Why would she be here to see Mede die? She did not know what it was she hated or what it was she loved. Love that wants only to get, to possess, is a monstrous thing, Ganil thought. She loved him. She stood separated from him only by the width of that square. She would never be willing to see that she was separated from him by her own act, by ignorance, by exile, by death. They brought Mede out just before noon. Ganil glimpsed his face. It was very white, all his deformity exposed, the atavistic pallor of skin, hair, eyes. There was no drawing out of the scene. A gold-robed priest raised his crossed arms in invocation to the sun that stood, unseen, at noon behind the pall of clouds. And as he lowered his arms, torches were set to the stacks of wood round the stake. Smoke curled up, the same grey-yellow as the clouds. Ganil stood with his injured hand in its sling, pressed hard against the roll of papers under his cloak, repeating silently, "Let the smoke suffocate him first." But the wood was dry and caught quickly. He felt the heat on his face, on his fire-scarred temple. Beside him a young priest tried to draw back, could not because of the pressing, staring, sighing crowd, and stood still, swaying a little and breathing in gasps. The smoke was thick now, hiding the flames and the figure among them. but Ganil could hear his voice. Not soft now, loud, very loud. He heard it. He forced himself to hear it. But at the same time, he listened in his spirit to a steady voice, soft, continuing, "What is the sun? Why does it cross the sky? Do you see how I need your numbers? For XII, write 12. This is also a figure for nothing." The screaming had stopped, but the soft voice had not. Ganil raised his head. The crowd was drifting away. The young priest knelt on the pavement by him, praying and sobbing aloud. Ganil glanced up at the heavy sky and then set off alone through the streets of the city, and out through the city gate, northward, into exile, and towards his home.